Blog Talk Radio.
Anyway, Nick Diaz is the fighter I'm talking about.
and he's talking about going over to boxing, and apparently he has a contract already with Fernando Vargas waiting for a signature.
Really?
Yes. So he's not taking it lightly, not starting at the bottom. He wants to go right after the big dog. And he's been complaining a little bit about money.
Do it, man. Do it right.
Right. He's been complaining a little bit about money, and it was kind of interesting because Scott Coker, the CEO of Strikeforce, where Diaz fights in MMA, has shot back a little and said something in an interview that I saw about, well, you know, he's complaining he doesn't have enough money, but, you know, I don't see him, I saw him driving around the other day in his Ferrari, you know, he didn't look too unhappy. He can pretty much buy any car he wants, but obviously, yeah, as we've talked about in that debate series that we had, we kept coming back to the money issue. And boxing obviously offers guys at the higher levels way more than MMA does still to this day. It's one of the main consistent things that makes me surprised we haven't seen more of this transition from MMA to boxing for some of these guys. But Diaz had a very weird interview after the fight where he said he was sure he was going to be suspended for what happened in the ring, the cage. It was a very interesting fight, a little bit of a controversial stoppage. There was 3 seconds left in the first round when he knocked Daly out. It's a TKO, and yeah, probably Daly could have survived those 3 seconds without getting completely knocked out. But you know, John McCarthy was the referee, and he's pretty well known. And, he was right on top of things, literally. So I think benefit of the doubt goes to him. But either way, it was a very impressive fight. So Diaz came back from getting stunned a couple times. And went on to get the victory. And it was one of those knockouts that apparently Daly said it was a slip, and it looked very funny the way he got hit. And then, like, maybe 5 seconds later, he did, like, the stagger leg and then fell. And yeah. He just hopped right on top of him and nailed him with a few more punches, and that was it. So it was a little bit weird, but I think Diaz definitely did a very good job and deserved to win. But now he's saying that he thought he was gonna get suspended. He did get suspended medically, but nothing for his conduct or anything like that, even though he's talking a lot of trash and acting a little weird inside the cage. And he got tagged up quite a bit in the face. So I don't know how long he's gonna be off because of that. But supposedly he's just waiting for Fernando Vargas to sign this contract. And the only option he has to stay in MMA is to fight, I guess, he wants to fight Anderson Silva, who's like the number one UFC guy. And from what we've been hearing, Dana White and the UFC brass aren't going to be switching fighters over from Strikeforce to the UFC. If anything, the UFC guys are going to go over to Strikeforce. Because of the contract issues. But then again, read an article over the weekend that talked about how they're getting very anxious to gobble up Strikeforce and make it a merger. And Dana obviously was not telling the truth when he said that he wasn't going to go to Strikeforce events in his first big conference call. He said that because he was right at ringside, at Cape Side, at the last Strikeforce event this past weekend. And he was drinking Zions from the rest that I read. It's energy, I guess. But that's kind of funny. So that's your big news, that boxing is definitely not dead, because MMA guys now moving over.
Well, and, you know, you brought up a good point. And let me give my theory on it, because my theories are always very, you know, theoretic. You're saying, like, okay, a lot of you know, MMA guys are, you know, have not stepped into the boxing ranks. Well, some boxers have stepped into the MMA ranks, and Keter is, you know, and I'm going to obviously take the boxer side in this. What a surprise! But here's, like, you know, my kind of opinion on it. You look at it one way. okay, for a boxer that, you know, does the traditional sport of boxing, a lot of challenges out there, absolutely. But, you see, MMA is a whole different kind of challenge. It's a different kind of fighting, and, you know, for a competitor, that's, you know, I mean, you know, an obstacle. Something seems like pretty cool. Plus, you look at it this way. You know, you get a lot of these guys, you know, they're making more money, but they're like, you know what? Maybe I can get better, bigger exposure, and maybe I can, you know, become a bigger name by stepping into this, you know, type of fighting, this cage fighting, and, you know, getting publicity for it, you know? So that's why James Toney did it, and he obviously lost and lost badly. Other guys have done it. Mixed result with Gray Mercer, Butterbean, a few other guys. But then you look at it this way. A lot of mixed martial artists are not eager to step into the world of boxing because they feel that the style of fighting will handcuff them. And most of them know, theoretically, as a boxer, I know if I try to go into a fight like with a martial artist and, you know, and I get taken down, yeah, I'm in deep shit. I'll admit that first and foremost. But a lot of these guys don't want to admit that if they had to fight strictly stand up against a trained boxer, they're going to get knocked out in the first round. And, I mean, that's just my thing. And, you know, so they're going to say they feel handcuffed. And so, I mean, that's, like I said, only my opinion. And of course, I'm taking the boxer side of it, but, you know.
Well, it makes sense, you know. Although Diaz is a very good on the feet striker, he does throw a lot of punches. And he has a looping punch style.
But you look at it this way, Rich. A person that's a pretty good striker for an MMA fighter against a boxer is still a disadvantage. You get where I'm coming from?
His tool bag. Yeah. I mean, if it was Muay Thai boxing, it'd be one thing, but it's just throwing fists. So it's going to be difficult for him. But
of course,
at the same time, you know, I think he's got a good shot at making the transition. One of the things he said in that really weird interview with Ariel Helwani was, they hadn't been fighting him enough, they had been fighting him too much. So maybe that's another reason why you wanted to switch over, because at the higher levels where you're fighting longer fights, typically you might maybe fight two or three times a year rather than, you know, every month or so, like sometimes they do in MMA. So maybe that's what he's looking for too. But who knows what Nick Diaz is thinking. He's kind of out there. He's one of those guys that has been busted on the post-fight drug test for marijuana usage, so who knows what's going through that head of his. He's very outspoken. He gives the middle finger to people all the time. He even slapped away the camera in the cage after the fight, trying to get the shot of his busted up eye. So
you trying to say professional athletes, some of them do drugs?
Oh, yeah, of course.
By the way, a very famous former Red Sox just retired. Any comments?
Oh, Manny? You talking about Manny?
Yeah.
Manny being Manny? I thought we covered this last week.
Yeah. No, he didn't retire until this week, did he?
Oh, I don't know. Maybe. Yeah,
I don't remember. Maybe we did cover it last week. I don't remember. Maybe I was making fun of him last week.
Yeah.
Maybe I was thinking more of Barry Bonds this week. I don't know.
Yeah, well, at least this time he didn't take a female hormone. he definitely took a banned substance, steroid type deal. But actually, Barry Bonds just got off yesterday.
I heard.
Very shocked.
I heard.
That. But anyway, we got to cover a shitload of boxing. Pardon my French. But,
you know,
obviously, the biggest fight of the weekend was Morales and Maidana.
Yeah, I didn't see it, but I heard, you know, Morales, you know, he gave him a fight. I was a little bit surprised. I thought Maidana was going to roll through him. He's a bigger guy. He's a stronger guy. He's, you know, obviously the guy who hasn't been in his many wars. But Morales, you know, I mean, his eyes swelled up in the first round or whatever, but it didn't matter. He hung tough, and you got to take your hat off to a guy like that.
Yeah, and I don't know. I know how you feel about Larry the Mad Hatter Merchant there, but how about Jim Lampley? You like that guy?
Yeah, I do. I like and I respect Jim Lampley.
Well, I have a bone to pick with Jim Lampley.
Why?
But first of all, it doesn't seem like he speaks English sometimes because he really messes.
He uses big words, I'll give you that.
Well, even when he uses small words. I mean, he said at one point in the fight, you know, Morales has waked the arena up. You know, and then another point, he said, boxers expect to break their hands every time they fight.
No, I don't.
Yeah. Where did he come up with that? Where? I don't know. I mean, he definitely didn't get that from any trainer or any actual fighter telling him that. I never heard any fighter say that. Yeah, I break my hand every time I fight, you know. I expect to. And obviously, he's been busted for smoking pot himself, so a little too much before the fight. But I thought it was very interesting because, like you mentioned, the fight started with Morales getting tuned up in his right eye. It was real bad with the swelling. And Morales did land a lot early, but he didn't have any kind of KO power. But he really started coming alive in about the fifth round and had a real nice burst at the end of the sixth. And Maidana seemed to be getting tired, but he started getting stronger at the end of the seventh. And then by the eighth, Morales had him wobbled. He had hit him with a left hook and an uppercut. And the ninth was the best round of the fight, I think. And I think that's where Anthony said, you know, the arena is waked up. But then, really, after the ninth, it was anybody's fight. Both guys were really bombing away at each other. And I had the feeling that Maidana, at some point, had to be thinking, what do I have to do to take this guy out? And he actually, at the end of the fight, they interviewed him, and he said something exactly to that effect. You know, like he was hitting him with some hard shots, and he didn't know why the guy wasn't going down. On the 10th, Morales landed a real big right hook at the two-minute mark. Maidana seemed to be really losing the will and the strength to fight hard enough to win the championship rounds. But he came back late in the 10th, and then I lost the whole feed that I was watching in the 11th, so I didn't really see much of the 11th. But the 12th round, Maidana basically sealed the deal. He finished strong, and he definitely took the round. Still, though, a lot of people expected a draw. Some people expected Morales to win, but I think that was more because of his effort, you know, and because nobody expected him to do that well, I think. But as far as him winning, I doubt anybody could score to win technically for him, just because, you know, number one, he had the more damage to the face, even though you don't really count that usually. But number two, he just didn't win enough rounds. He had some moments in some of those rounds that he hurt Maidana more than Maidana ever hurt him. But, you know, he was using his speed more often than his power in those situations. And even that, he didn't use enough. He had his strengths, and he strung a lot of punches together and hit Maidana with some good shots, but he couldn't really put him down. And really the biggest compliment he got from most people was that they couldn't believe he did all that with just one eye.
Yeah, that eye looked pretty bad.
One eye. But it was a split decision win for Maidana. One judge had it 114-114, and the other two had it 116-112.
Okay, a majority decision. Majority decisions when there's one that gives it a draw and, well, two others with one guy.
You're right, my bad.
That's okay.
Now, also on that card, we had a very interesting upset. James Kirkland lost his first fight.
Yeah, first round.
Yeah, to a Japanese guy, fittingly named Nobuhiro. Nobuhiro Ishida, who was supposed to be just, you know, an opponent, basically. Comes in and makes his country proud. And, you know, he, obviously Kirkland complained about the stoppage, but he'd been knocked down before that, too. Just didn't look very sharp at all. Max Kellerman, give him some credits for having some balls. He went right in there in the ring and interviewed Kirkland and sort of blamed it right on the trainer switch. And Kirkland tried to kind of brush that off, you know, because I guess Kirkland has been training with Ann Wolf, who was a female fighter.
I did hear that, yeah.
And he stopped training with her and switched camps, and then this is the result. So Kellerman said, we had never
seen this. Sometimes it's funny. I mean, like you get, you know, there's sometimes that you have certain people you don't get the same results with. I mean, you might be working with a guy that's, you know, not a highly ranked trainer, or, you know, they don't have the pedigree that some other trainers do. Then you might move on and you might hire a guy like Emmanuel Stewart or Freddie Roach or somebody, you know, that is highly respected and, you know, thought of one of the greatest trainers out there, a guy like Teddy Atlas or something like that, and it might just not work. It might not work. It's just weird. It's the way some people respond to certain trainers or, you know, certain people respond to certain game plans.
Right. Also, on that card, Paulie Malignaggi did a unanimous decision in a pretty good.
Yeah, he got his revenge on the Cotto family.
Yeah. Wasn't very good.
He couldn't beat Miguel Cotto, so he settled for the brother.
Yep. It wasn't a very good fight. But
win's a win, then.
Right. Also, David Lemieux, I don't think this was on the same card, but...
No, it was on the Friday night card. I didn't get to see it because I had to work on Saturday morning, and they didn't show the fight live. They showed it on some website or something, and then they were going to replay it at, like, 1 something in the morning. And I was far asleep by that time because I had to be up so early. But, yeah, David Lemieux got shocked. And I called that one wrong, and I'll admit it, you know. The Rain Man was wrong.
Mark Antonio Rubio gets his 50th win with that. So.
Rubio's a tough fighter. You know, I thought that would actually be more of his detriment. You know, he's a very aggressive guy. You know, he's not the fastest guy in the world. So I was figuring, you know, he was going to come in face first and just, you know, be there to trade with Lemieux, who's you know, a pedigree fighter, power puncher, definitely had advantages and, you know, speed, power. But, you know, sometimes when you've been knocking guys out so fast in all your fights and somebody's able to drag you into that deeper water, well, then you're in trouble, you know, because sometimes you might not be able to respond to it.
Exactly. And we had a big upset between Danny O'Connor. Well, it's not really an upset. Both guys were undefeated. And Gabriel Bracero. So Danny O'Connor moves to 14-1. Bracero moves to 15-0. But I read an article today that detailed a situation with O'Connor spitting up blood before the fight.
Wow.
He went and fought anyway. Turns out he got tested and went to the hospital, and he's tested positive for anemia.
Sure.
So he had a very big excuse, but you know, a legitimate one at that, for not doing as well. And now it looks like these guys are going to have a rematch. The other undefeated Danny Garcia, went into his fight against Nate Campbell, and won that, so he's now 21-0. Robert Stieglitz got his 40th win against Corin Gaver, who got disqualified in the 10th. Even though I haven't read any.
And did you hear what he did after he got disqualified?
What?
Apparently, he had a major meltdown.
Really? I did not hear.
Oh, yeah. I was reading about it today. He's like apologizing to the referee. Apparently, he like flipped out on the referee and, I'll have to bring up the article, but he's like, yeah, he was flipping out here and, you know, just went completely nuts.
Wow.
No, it happens sometimes. You know, you get pissed off.
Well, it's not unheard of.
Boxing is an emotional sport, you know. Well, let me rephrase that. You know, people that are, you know, true competitors are going to be a lot of times emotional people. It's like, I have a very good friend of mine, and he and I are like polar opposite personalities. You know, we're both kind of goofy guys and everything, and we joke around, and, you know, oh my God, there's midgets on TV, and we're laughing and everything, and we're goofballs like that. But when it comes to competitive edge, he doesn't have it. He's too much of a nice guy. And I know he played football for, you know, my alma mater, Lock Haven, who actually Lock Haven hasn't won a game in like 4 years. But he was the type of guy that said, you know what, eh, you know, okay, we're playing. It's like, I'm the type of guy that's like, I would rather, you know, get my face chopped off than lose. And, you know, he's like more like, eh, ho-hum, you know, we lost, big deal. Now, it's like, well, if we go to, like, baseball games or, you know, shit like that, we'll go to a baseball game and, you know, if Phillies win, yeah, we're having a great time. Phillies lose, I don't want to talk to nobody. I'm going home, and we're on the way home, and I'm like, motherfucker, I can't believe they lost that game. And it's like, dude, they won, like, 12 straight games. They're 10 games ahead in first place. It doesn't matter. Yeah, it does. I came to a game and they lost. It matters. You know, what, do you want to be 162-0? No. I want to be 173-0. You know? That's me. So you get a lot of times, I mean, I've told you some of the things I did during my boxing tenure. The one time in down in Richmond, the VMI, when I lost to the one guy who's a two-time national champ from Navy, I got cut real bad in the mouth. I mean, to the point where I was holding my upper lip in half. And they stopped the fight. I cursed the doctor out. I called him this. I called him that. You know, flipped out on him. There was up in New York Athletic Center, I lost the fight. I told, I can't tell you how many people off. And then one of the last fights that when I lost that bullshit decision to your boy Jesse Bond. I actually took me 12 years to bury the hatchet with one of the judges. Because I felt that he wronged me. I was pissed off about it. And part of me still is.
Yeah, it's not easy.
No, I mean, when you consider yourself a true competitor, you always want to win. You know, and losing is unacceptable. I remember there was a quote, and I really believe in it. If you can accept losing, then you cannot win.
Wow. I don't know if I agree with that. Anyway, we had a couple other fights to talk about before we get on our guest. Robert Guerrero, of course, had a very impressive fight against Michael Katsidis.
I heard.
Katsidis tried to psych him out right away. I sort of turned away. I didn't see it, but I heard it. When they went to touch gloves, Katsidis yelled out, "What are you looking at?" And then they touched gloves, and that was his most aggressive moment of the night.
Sure.
Except for when he was throwing low blows. He got away with a lot of extra ones they didn't call, too. But yeah, he got warned. I think he had a point taken off for a couple low blows. But Guerrero just dominated. Katsidis threw a few bombs that I thought would kind of stagger Guerrero, but he just kind of waded right through them. And he landed so many more shots. It was just unbelievable. They did the punch stab graphic after the fight, and I was just like, I was just shocked. I couldn't believe how many shots he landed. He landed over 250 headshots alone.
Wow.
Right.
Well, Casitas has never been the best defensive fighter out there.
Right. And, you know, because of the psych out at the beginning, what you saw at the end was kind of weird. Usually when two guys go toe-to-toe like that for an entire fight, they hug right away, then they go to their corners. And Guerrero just kind of gave him a look and then turned his back on him. And I thought that was kind of interesting. But, you know, after the fighters had relaxed a little bit before the decision, he did go over and, you know, acknowledge him. They had their hugging moment. But I don't know whether that was a personal thing at first or just because he was caught up in the moment, but or it was sort of weird. Then we had, of course, Adamek against McBride. I got to watch that as well. It was going on at the same time. I kind of was going back and forth. It was sort of a warm-up fight more than anything, I think, for Adamek. But it's a warm-up fight for the Klitschko's. Either one of them is going to roll over Adamek based on that performance, I think. Because McBride, I mean, he's obviously got a ton of experience, but he's got no speed anymore. He's not in tip-top shape. He has lost a lot of weight, it looks like, since I last saw him.
I'm going to tell you what's really going to hurt Adamek in a fight with the Klitschko's. Okay, Adamek, as I said, been here a few weeks ago. I think he's using this as an audition, you know, to prepare himself for the Klitschko's. They're basically like the perfect, setup opponents for him. The last two guys he fought, Michael Grant, 6'7", 250-some pounds, big guy, very athletic. But Michael Grant, I like him. I've never met him personally, but I have friends of mine that met him in Norristown, which is only about 20 minutes from where I live. Michael Grant is a very, very nice guy, doesn't have a whole lot of killer instinct. So that was, you know, one thing. And you can tell his confidence is shot. I mean, 11 years ago, going into those fights with Andrew Gallada and then Lennox Lewis, yeah, he was very confident. But, you know, that fight against Lennox Lewis really shattered him. And the fight against Jamil McClain, where he got knocked down on the first punch of the fight and shattered his ankle, really hurt him. And he never came back from him. I saw him fight on the Gotti Ward 3 undercard in Atlantic City against Dominic Gwynn. And I really thought he had a good shot at beating Gwynn. But I was like, but he has to come and, you know, really focus and ready to do it because Gwynn is a good fighter. And people are like, oh, Grant's going to kill him. I said, no. I said, if he doesn't come ready to fight, he's not going to kill nobody. And Gwynn, I mean, dropped him like four times and knocked him out cold. So Grant was a good setup for Adamek. Now, McBride, also a huge guy, 6'6", like 280-some pounds, huge guy. But look, McBride is not Klitschko, either one of them. He doesn't have Vitaly's, steely demeanor and killer instinct. And I always said this before, Vitaly is the less talented brother, but I think he's the better fighter. Vladimir is more talented, but I don't think he's got Vitaly's killer instinct. But either way, I saw in that Adamek fight with Steve Cunningham a couple years ago, the one that you and I did the color commentary on, that Adamek is easy to hit. Now, Steve Cunningham, world champion, great fighter. Steve Cunningham is not a power puncher. Steve is a very good boxer. He's a very slick guy. He's got a lot of skills. Got a good right hand, but he's not a guy that's going to knock you out. You know, nobody's ever going to confuse him with a guy like Bob Foster, okay? And he had Adamek hurt on three or four occasions. I mean, to the point, he was lifting his feet up. He was lifting Adamek's left foot up when he'd hit him with a right hand. He was hitting him that hard. Adamek's got a good chin. But now you look at a guy, let's just say, Vladimir Klitschko, who is 50 pounds heavier than Steve Cunningham, and Vladimir Klitschko, who is more, even Steve Cunningham at 250 pounds would not be punching as hard as Vladimir Klitschko.
Well,
what do you think that spells for Thomas Adamek? Spells deep shit.
He's not going to do so well. It was crazy the way he was trying to fight McBride. You know, he was just sort of running around the ring. And obviously McBride's a big, slow guy. He just kind of plods around after people at this point in his career, not as aggressive and fast as he used to be. But
not that he was ever really aggressive or not as ever he was ever fast.
Right. He was throwing more slow and slapping punches, too, than actually jabs or you know, anything accurate and hard. It just seemed like it was one at a time, you know, here and there. And it was a real tough battle for him because he has a very good defense. I mean, McBride, neither one of them looked like they were going to fight after the fight. You know, they weren't tagged up at all. And it seemed more like a sparring match than anything, I thought. But he did knock Adamek down a bunch of times. Not from punches, though. It was more like his footing was lost. It was like Adamek thought he was in a fire drill or something when they stopped, drop, and roll. Because he got thrown around a lot and tripped up. And it just didn't look good for him. You know, this is the guy that's supposed to have a ton of experience, and he's supposed to be doing this for a practice run at the Klitschko's. And I don't know any promoter that would watch that fight and say, oh, yeah, he's ready. He's ready for the Klitschko's. No way. I mean, he has a lot of work to do. And, you know, he had his basically all his chances to go way more aggressive and to actually fight McBride. But McBride, you know, was throwing punches even when they were toe-to-toe. It didn't do anything to Adamek, and he still shied away from him and still ran around the ring. So it just doesn't leave me confident that he's going to have any kind of a good fight against the Klitschko's if he tries to fight either one of them next.
We'll see. Maybe he'll prove me wrong. He was just kind of taking it easy.
I think I tried to do against Michael Jordan.
But, let's get our guest on the phone.
Actually, I need a couple of seconds here. Put him on the contact list. We're going to be talking to Eric Gargiulo, who is the editor, owner of Camel Clutch, the blog. It's a wrestling blog. We're going to be chatting about professional wrestling for the first time in a long time. Actually, I
love professional wrestling.
I don't think we talked
about it. Saying earlier, the Camel Clutch. My mom used to love the Iron Sheik. She used to love his handlebar mustache. And you said, did she like Ravishing Rick Rude? I said, hell no. She thought King Kong Bundy was way sexy. Or way sexier. He had better abs than Rick Rude.
Yeah, King Kong Bundy ended up working for IBM. You hear that?
He ended up doing what?
Working for IBM.
Did he really?
That's what I heard, yeah.
I heard he was doing some stand-up comedy and was pretty good at it. I never saw any of it, but I can imagine. I was watching an interview he did, like a real interview, not like a fake wrestling promo interview. And he was funny. He really was. He was just telling stories.
Hello?
Hello, Eric.
Hey, is this Rich?
This is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron. How's it going?
Very good. How you doing, Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron?
Pretty good. We also have Tony the Tornado Pennacal on the line with us.
Oh, what's up, Tony?
Not too much. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. How are you guys all doing tonight?
All right.
Oh, we're doing great. It's almost Friday.
Yeah, absolutely. I'd be a little better if the Flyers could score a goal, but other than that, doing pretty well.
You know what? I actually got tickets to game 2 on Saturday.
Ah, do you really?
Yeah, a friend of mine works for the Phillies, and he couldn't go.
Okay.
So he threw him up for grabs, and I grabbed.
Lucky guy, man. Have a good time. I'm sure it'll be fun.
Are you a Philadelphia guy? Or?
Yeah. I live in Philly.
Oh, really? What part?
I live in Northeast. I live in Northeast Philadelphia, and I mean, I've been pretty much born and raised here since I was 5 years old. So yeah, Philadelphia guy for sure.
Yeah, you know, I would.
Is there Tony? We lose you?
Uh oh! Sounds like the tornado blew away.
Can you hear me?
Oh, there he is. He's back.
Yeah, I'm here.
There you go.
Yeah, I said I was born in Cheltenham, and I live above Lansdowne now.
Oh, okay, yeah. I mean, I went to high school up there. I saw a family up in that area. Chalfont, like Chalfont Doylestown.
Yeah, that's about 20-some minutes from me.
Yep, yeah. Know exactly where you are. Small world, right?
Yeah, right. I was like, the first thing you get somebody on the line, they're like, yeah, I'm watching the Flyers game. I'm like, yeah, so am I.
Yeah, absolutely. I started watching the Flyers game. I'm like, man, I did book that interview tonight, right?
Oh, it won't keep you too long.
No. I'm just playing. It's fine. There'll be four other games.
Yeah. All right. Well,
hopefully there will only be four total games because the Flyers are going to sweep them out the door.
That's what I'm saying.
Tell us a little bit about your blog there and your work in wrestling there.
Sure. Are we live on the air?
Yes, we are.
Oh, okay. All right, good stuff. Well, I guess we'll start with my blog. My blog is camelclutchblog.com, and, of course, named after the great finishing move of the Iron Sheik. What it is, it really just kind of started as just an outlet to write about wrestling and MMA and whatever else I decided to watch that weekend every once in a while, and it's really just turned into a nice little business and quite a little monster. It's definitely predominantly wrestling. I would say wrestling is the majority of the content, but it's got everything on there. It's got a ton of UFC. I'd say it's wrestling and UFC mostly, but during the football season, there's a ton of fantasy football, NFL. There'll probably be some baseball stuff coming up. So, predominantly wrestling, but it's really just about anything I'm interested in, quite honestly, is what I do with it. And I have about 40 different writers, not all of them write all the time, but I have about 40 different contributors, which is great because, you know, I might write an article about Edge retiring and have a different slant than somebody else that's writing about it. So it's pretty cool in that readers can go and go on the site every day and get a different viewpoint. And I populate it with fresh content Monday through Friday, usually once on the weekends. Every once in a while, I'll just, you know, there'll be something going on and I'll populate it on the weekends. But, yeah, we try and get up about 3 to 5 new articles a day, and it's really all opinion based. You know, you're not going to go there and find breaking news for the most part. What you're going to find is opinions on that breaking news, and I'm very proud of it. It's been plugged regularly on Sports Illustrated's website. Fox Sports has featured my blogs on there. NBC Sports, Yahoo News. So, yeah, I would hope all of your great listeners here would check it out, and it's over at camelclutchblog.com. And as far as my wrestling goes, I'll give you the Cliff Notes version because I've been in wrestling now for well over 10 years, so I won't give you the gory details. But for the most part, broke into the wrestling business as a ring announcer with ECW, the real ECW, in 1996. Yeah, exactly. Not the fake.
Yeah.
Not that bullshit carbon copy stuff they have going on now.
Exactly. So I broke in there in 96 and was a ring announcer for them for about a year and a half. And I did all the road shows. I really didn't do any of the Philly shows, but I would do the road shows because their regular ring announcer was unable to go on the road, and it was just awesome. You know, part of my job, which is crazy as it sounds, but part of my job was being, I guess, like a fly on the wall to Paul Heyman before the shows, because as a ring announcer, I would have to know what was going to happen out there, just so I was aware and I was kind of up to date on finishes, angles, that kind of thing. So my job was to kind of shadow Paul before the shows, and I mean, talk about getting your doctorate in pro wrestling booking, just sitting there and listening to him book angles, listening to him trying to talk guys into doing jobs and trying to, go over grudges between certain guys. I mean, it was just a blast, and a phenomenal experience for a kid that grew up watching wrestling. Got out of that after a little while and started my radio show, Pro Wrestling Radio, in 1999, and did that on terrestrial radio for about 10 years. Still do it from time to time now, but you can go to prowrestlingradio.com and download old interviews and classic interviews, and whenever I decide to fire up the microphone and do a show, you can find new ones on there. But you know, I guess you could say I made my bones as a pro wrestling play-by-play announcer. In 2000, I started with Combat Zone Wrestling here in the Philly area. They were the ones that gave me my break doing wrestling announcing. And I started with them in 2000. I was horrendous, probably for the first year and a half, because, I mean, I'd never done it before. Really lucked into the opportunity, but I really studied hard. And when I say studied hard, you know, I mean, I watched tapes constantly. Well, I guess you could say listened to tapes constantly of, you know, people that I respected, like Jim Ross from Mid-South and UWF, and people like that calling matches, trying to take it and make it my own. On top of that, just being a big sports fan, what I like to do was listen to sports on the radio and hear how the announcers on the radio would call the games, because, you know, I don't know about you guys, but, you know, the announcers on radio, they're the best sports broadcasters in sports, I think, because they have a tough job and they do it really well. So I try to blend all those elements of real sport and Jim Ross and classic wrestling, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And at the end of 2001, with Cage of Death 3, CZW kind of broke. I mean, they just got pretty big overnight, so to speak, and I was lucky enough to be a part of that, so I was able to get a ton of wrestling announcing work out of that, just kind of being the face of CZW, and I've been around the business for a while, too, so I've known a lot of people and had some good networking and connections, and yeah, for about 10 years, did wrestling announcing for just about all the major independent companies, CZW, Ring of Honor, Chikara, and, you know, every ham and egg, you know, overnight company with a good budget for a broadcaster, MLW, Court Bowers, MLW, I was down there. Who else? I did a lot of pay-per-view stuff for, like, Women's Extreme Wrestling, the Japanese Hardcore Wrestling, Shane Douglas's Hardcore Homecoming, Pro Wrestling Unplugged here in Philly. And then I guess you could say in about 2007 or so, just everything started to change. You know, the landscape of independent wrestling started to change. The economy hit rock bottom. So, you know, a struggling independent wrestling company, who's the first person that they're going to cut to stay on the budget would be me as a play-by-play announcer. And I get it. But at the same time, being around for as long as I have, I wasn't going to take a serious pay cut. I would just, you know, I found other opportunities. I found other priorities in my life, and just my life was changing, the business was changing, and we just kind of went our separate ways. And from then, from 2007 to now, every once in a while, I'll pop up and do these here and there. Again, you know, just in this economy, there's not a whole lot of money for a wrestling commentator, you know, in the budget, and I totally get it, but I'm going to be doing a show for the Continental Wrestling Federation in Florida, which I'm pretty excited about, in Orlando. I think for me, as a wrestling announcer, this new trend of these internet pay-per-views that really helps somebody like me, not that I'm really looking to get back in the business full-time, but, you know, these independent wrestling companies now have to put a little more of an emphasis back on commentary because they want to do it live and do it for the internet pay-per-views. So I've got a lot of phone calls and a lot of emails over the last couple of months, and like I said, Continental Wrestling Federation. I know I'm going to be doing voiceovers for a company out of Virginia, and I think they're called the AWF, but I'm not exactly sure what they're called. And I think that Marvin Ward is it's his company down there. So it's one of those things where, you know, I'm never fully out, but, you know, I always keep my toe in the water, but, you know, certainly don't do it nearly as much as I used to, but had some great times and great memories, and was really, you know, I really had the opportunity to call matches in indie wrestling when it was at its peak, you know, back in like the mid-2000s, early 2000s, you know, a lot of guys, a lot of really talented guys that are now in WWE and TNA, but they were breaking in and stuff, so yeah, it's kind of, in a nutshell, my wrestling career anyway.
Yeah, that's a lot of stuff.
Eric, what I did while we were talking, I'm sitting at my desk. I got two games on and doing my show and navigating online.
Nice.
I went to your Facebook page and I friend requested you for one. The second thing is, obviously we have a lot of mutual friends. And when the first thing you mentioned ECW, I had a very good friend of mine that knew all of the guys. I still talk to him from time to time. I see he's a mutual friend, Sebastian Catania.
Oh God, that's a name from the past. Sebastian, he has the long hair, right? Back in the day.
He's buzzed now. He's shaved.
Oh yeah, I know Sebastian. He was always a really cool dude. I mean, we never hung out or anything, but I used to talk to him at shows and stuff. Because I actually got my foot in the door in ECW, working at our video and the tape tables and stuff. So it's like it was such a small community back then that just hanging out at the tape tables and stuff, you would meet everybody throughout the shows. And it's funny, now what is it like 10, 15 years later? And, a lot of us, we're still friendly, It's like we hook up on Facebook or, Twitter or something. Every once in a blue moon, I'll get a request on Facebook or somebody will pop by my blog and be like, hey, it's Billy from ECW. And I'm like, holy crap, I remember that. But, yeah, I remember Sebastian. Absolutely, really good dude.
Yeah, I hadn't seen him because he actually, when he was – I met him, I guess, around 96. He and the girl he was dating at the time, their daughter was only, like, a baby, and then another, like, friend or two of theirs. They were living in, like, a townhouse right up the street from me. So, and I was home from college, and I was training for boxing at the time, so I'd be down South Philly every night, training at a gym, busting my ass every night. So I'd only get to see him maybe like on weekends and stuff. It was more like, hey, how you doing? And then we were having a block party later that summer, and I was recovering from knee surgery. So the whole time I was recovering, I was pretty much like staying inside. I was really laid up. I was having trouble getting around. So then we had this block party, and I was really starting to feel better about myself. And so I'm up there, and I'm talking to him. Hey, how you doing? So we're sitting there talking. And then a couple years later, I moved out in 2001, and he was there for another year or so because I know the one time I was back down in Glenside, he saw me at a bar, and he's like, you're not driving home. No way. He's like, you're staying at the house tonight. He goes, I don't care if you sleep on the couch, sleep on the floor or whatever. I'm taking your keys. He's a good guy like that. So I was like, I literally stayed no more than 100 yards from where I grew up. So we're sitting there talking, and he was like, I never knew you were a wrestling fan.
Wow.
I'm like, hell yeah. I'm like, because, I was up at college most of the time, and we'd have big, huge parties in my house. Hey, it's pay-per-view. It's going to be WrestleMania 12. We're going to watch it. We'd get every pay-per-view we could, everyone we could afford.
Yeah.
And ECW, I was starting to really get into it at the time, but I could only watch it when I was home because I was at school upstate, and they didn't get it up there. So I used to actually take the matches just to show to my friends up at school. I'm like, you got to see this. They're fighting the cheese graters. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, absolutely.
So he was joking around with me the one time because he goes, I never knew you were. I'm like, dude, I'm like, I grew up watching Hulk Hogan, Andre the Giant. My dad took me to matches. I said, I went the first WrestleMania they showed at the Spectrum on the big screen. And I remember watching it when I was 8 years old. I was so excited.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about it. He goes, you watch ECW. I'm like, yeah, I watch it from time to time. It's pretty cool. He goes, what do you think about Joel Gertner? I said, the quintessential stud muffin? He goes, yeah. I said, I'm going to beat his ass if I ever see him. And he's laughing about it. We are cracking up. And I'm like, obviously, you know the guy's playing a part. He goes,
yeah.
You think Joel was, when I first moved here, he was my roommate? I'm like, no. I'm like, listen, there's a guy whose ass I was going to beat if I ever saw him on the street living there more than 100 yards from me.
Yeah, wow, he's right down the street from your house.
Yeah, and then the thing is, because I was boxing at the time, and I was just, starting to really become, the year that when they were first moved there, I was second in the Northeast region. I just went to Nationals
because I lost to the eventual national champion in the regional finals. So
okay.
I was getting there, you know, building up pretty good. Then I was convalescing from a knee surgery. So, and that was the thing, is like I was starting to become pretty popular in my neighborhood because it was very, you know, close knit. And
sure, that's the way Philly neighborhoods are. Yeah.
Yeah, and Sebastian told me years later, he goes, you know, we always heard about you and everything, but we knew you were home recovering and all that. And he goes, you know, we were always going to, and Joel really wanted to be in everything. And I'm like, he goes, but he was afraid you would have just blew him off as some, like, phony wrestling guy. I'm like, no, man, I probably would have beat his ass. Just for being
that's what I'm thinking.
Stupid neck brace and everything, but.
Yeah, gosh, small world.
Yeah.
One thing I remember about ECW, I actually went to one of their shows up in Webster, Massachusetts, where my dad was chief of police. And Killer Kowalski was sitting on the stage in just a folding chair with his arms across his chest. Watching the whole thing. And, you know, my dad was actually the first one to tell me about Kowalski. I had never heard of him before that. And,
yeah.
You know, he told me about the famous fight where he ripped the guy's ear off and.
Yes.
It was one of my first big old school wrestling lessons, but it was kind of funny seeing it from his perspective or sitting next to him while he was watching it because, you know, he was talking to all the people in the town that ran the function hall and everything like that, and he was sitting next to one of the state senators, and it was kind of funny when they started breaking tables. He was just like, and going, oh, they're going to be pissed.
Yeah.
It was a pretty good show. Lots of blood, lots of audience interaction. You know, I remember they had one guy getting dragged through the balcony by the hair.
Wow.
Blood all over the place, and it was definitely fan friendly for sure.
Yeah, definitely. You know, those are some great times. I mean, you know, for me, I mean, talk about having the best seat in the house. You know, as a ring announcer, I'm sitting ringside for this stuff, which sometimes wasn't a good seat, you know, depending on who was throwing what and from what direction. But, you know, for the most part, it was quite an experience. I mean, one of the best times of my life, for sure.
Right. And I've actually been... Well, I guess lucky enough to be. I haven't really been a huge fan of wrestling myself, but all throughout my life, I've always had at least one friend who was just religiously into it.
Yeah.
My best friend growing up was, and I specifically remember, you know, at one point when he was talking about Ken Shamrock going over to MMA, and just thinking and wondering about, you know, like what is that going to be like, you know, no holds barred type stuff when it.
Yeah.
Starting to circulate, but I never watched it back then. I didn't start watching it until 2006.
Yeah.
End up being one of the people who writes about it all the time. Like, it's kind of hard for me to believe, looking back, that you know, I didn't take as much of an interest in it then. But that was one of my friends who believed that wrestling was real until his teenage years. I mean, this guy was into it.
Wow, he's hardcore.
Yeah. And then in college, I was roommates with a guy who used to watch it religiously. The WCW was his favorite.
Okay.
A little ticked off when the WWE took that over.
Yeah. You know, WCW, they had their fans. And, you know, it's interesting. I guess they went out of business 2001. And
Yep. Here
we are 10 years later. And a lot of those fans never came back. You know, once they went away, WCW, you know, a lot of their fans just stayed away.
Guy was Big Papa Pump.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people like Big Papa Pump.
Last year. I met him at a show in Ambler, PA last year.
Oh, okay. Yeah, because he does the indies now in the area.
Yeah. I met him and Nikolai Volkov.
Tony got in a flexing contest with him.
The one picture on my Facebook page is great because, like, I was getting my picture with him.
Yeah.
So as I'm getting there, my one friend takes the camera. I'm looking the other way, and he's extending his hand to me, and it looks like he's, like, begging to shake my hand.
Wow, that's awesome.
If you want to look at something pretty funny, wrestling, like I said, I grew up being a wrestling fan. Then for a while, when I was, like, getting, like sophomore through my senior year of high school, maybe my freshman year of college, at the time, like, wrestling wasn't really quote-unquote cool, you know. The Hulk Hogan phase was pretty much done. You know, he was like, you know, I think that was like around the time he was wrestling guys like Sid Justice and everything, and doing that, and it wasn't as cool. So I kind of got away from it, but then when I got to college, you know, then it really picked up again, and that was around the time like Stone Cold Steve Austin was breaking out, and The Rock was about to start. So you really got, you know, drugged back into it. So every year for Halloween, like whether I was up at school or whether I was eating parties down here, I would look, what are you going to be this year? And I always think of a wrestler to be. The one guy that I was 3 years in a row, actually, a friend of mine looked like Steve Austin, except he had brown eyes. So he put on an Austin shirt, and he had, like, you know, and he put, like, tape on his wrist and everything. And he went as Stone Cold. It was 97, so I went as Dude Love.
Okay.
I went as Dude Love, and I was in college, I couldn't afford a true Dude Love shirt. I just got a tie-dye shirt and, you know, a wig and some shades and all that, and it was funny. So the next year, I'm like, well, if I was Dude Love, I'm like, I'm now going to be Mankind. I wore one of them, and somebody looked at me, they're like, it was a little kid, was like, can I get your autograph? I'm like, I'm not the real Mankind.
Yeah.
but I other ones I did the just about a year or so ago, I dressed as the Undertaker, but I'm like, no, I'm not going to be doing this, you know, modernized. I'm like, I'm doing the old.
You're going old school.
Stand ups with the long gloves and all that.
Yeah, you're going old school.
Bitch. I did like the white makeup. But everybody says all the wrestlers that I dressed up as, probably the favorite one was Randy Macho Man Savage.
Okay.
And the way I did the costume was I got a red satin jacket. I ordered it off eBay for like $10. And this is one I really, my job was kind of phasing out, so I had a lot of spare time. And I got home, bought strips of black and white material, and I just cut strips of like this nylon and glued it all throughout the arms of the jacket. And then I made like a design on the back. I traced and cut out the letters Macho Man and glued them on the back. And then I took a pair of black workout pants and I put like glitter strips or those sequin strips down the side. And I put red and white like fringe type material all down that. Since I boxed, I used a pair of my boxing boots. Had a pair of shutter shades, and I got a big red sequin cowboy hat.
That sounds awesome.
Yeah, it's on my Facebook page. Yeah, just go to my Halloween album, you'll see all my wrestling costumes.
Okay.
Now, Eric, I ask you the
gotta have fun.
Speaking.
Yeah, absolutely.
The Undertaker, Tony just mentioned. Now, what did you think about that? I don't know if you saw it, the Ariel Helwani interview after the Brock Lesnar fight.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I did a lot of writing about it. There's quite a few articles in Camel Clutch blog about it. You know, I think they're working the angle. I really do. I mean, they're two smart guys, and there was quite a buzz before that fight even that Brock Lesnar was in the works for WrestleMania. I think Vince McMahon was convinced that Brock Lesnar was a signed, sealed, delivered deal for WrestleMania, and I believe those guys were working the angle for the payday at WrestleMania. I really do. I don't think that was a shoot at all. I mean, you know, Undertaker gets the seats from Dana White. So I think the last thing he's going to do is go down there and cause trouble. And let's be honest, Undertaker can barely wrestle these days. You know, he's so banged up from injuries. You know, he doesn't want to fight Brock Lesnar. I mean, Brock Lesnar will destroy him in a second. So, you know, it's I think it's just a big work. And Brock Lesnar actually did an interview with Ariel Helwani a couple of weeks back, and he's like, hey, you know, bring it on. Ariel asked him what kind of a chance he'd give The Undertaker, and he said, I don't give him a chance in hell. So, I love it. I love I love those kind of angles. It was fun, but it was definitely interesting.
Yeah, I was really kind of ticked off about it, the way that people just ran with it, like, you know, that's what they were talking about, when all he did was say, do you want to do it, you know?
Yeah.
What is it? Everybody just assumed it was fight Brock at WrestleMania, and I think it has nothing to do with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Listen to what Ariel asked him afterwards. He said, what do you mean by that? And he says, the first thing out of his mouth is, I think he needs to train harder, you know? And then he said, it's personal. So I had the feeling like maybe it was talking something to do with their workouts, if they had worked out together when they were with the WWE, or
if they had, you know, used a certain trainer or done a certain thing with, you know, whatever it was. I even thought maybe they were using a veiled thing with steroids. That's why he didn't outright say it, you know. And we WWE is notorious for, you know, guys doing steroids and it being kind of looked the other way on. But
right.
You know, whatever it was, I just was really just kind of miffed that these fans would just take it like automatically that it had something to do with Brock going back to the WWE, because it seemed like nobody was taking the angle of, well, why would Brock do that, you know? Because it would make him look like a wuss if he do that. You know, win or lose against Velasquez, if you're going to make the change to real fighting and then you go back to entertainment fighting, I mean, how are you going to be perceived in the public eye? You're going to, maybe they'll like it, the wrestling fans, but the MMA fans are going to put your head on a platter.
Oh, definitely. I totally agree with you there. I just think, you know, I've heard a couple of interviews with Brock over the last couple of months where he said this year and next year his goal is to make as much money as possible. And I get it, because at his age, you know, how many more years does he have left, you know, in the peak of his fighting career? I mean, you know, one way to make as much money as possible is to go wrestle at WrestleMania and make $3 million. And, you know, he would have made $5 million. I don't know. I know they paid, you know, Floyd Mayweather said he was paid $20 million, but I believe that was a work. I don't believe he was paid $20 million. But maybe Brock makes $15 million, you know, for a fake wrestling match. And it's like, you know, I get it, and I think he definitely would be taking a hit in the face of MMA fans, which is why Dana White wouldn't let him. And I totally get that, because he's got to protect his asset right there. But from a business standpoint, you know, I can't say I blame him. You know, I don't know, you know, if Rashad Evans was offered $20 million to wrestle at WrestleMania, if you wouldn't take it. I mean, you know, for these guys, you know, some of these guys like St. Pierre, he's in camp all year long. I mean, he's training all year long, and then you have guys that, you know, train hard for 3 months before their fight and take time off. But with wrestling, it's like you don't have to train, you only have to wrestle once, you only have to do it for 5-10 minutes. You know, for the most part, you know, you're not going to get hurt. I mean, stuff happens. I mean, it happens all the time in wrestling. But, you know, for the most part, you know, you're not going to get punched in the face by Cain Velasquez. That's for sure. Shane Carlin. So, you know, at that same time, it's like, I can't say I necessarily blame him. I don't know if I was in this position, if I wouldn't take it either.
Right. Well, I didn't think it was going to happen, but at the same time, like, I did think if there was a possibility of it happening, that Dana White, you know, I'm not a big fan of him to begin with, but
yeah,
it's sort of detrimental to the growth of the sport when you've got another sport that's, you know, like we said, entertainment-based, but it reaches a lot of fans, you know, and that's where the MMA grew out of, is wrestlers going over to fight in MMA. So I think to foster a better marketing campaign, he probably should have let him do that. But the thing that handcuffed him was that he didn't let any of his other fighters do any other sport. You know, that was one of the big things with trying to sign Fedor. If Fedor couldn't do the Sambo, then he didn't want
right.
He didn't want to go to
the
UFC. So.
The one thing I said about the Brock Lesnar Undertaker possibility when it was first discussed, you know, a matter of months ago, I said, honestly, I saw that. I mean, the only people I could see potentially winning out of that would be, you know, Vince McMahon, obviously.
Right.
He's going to make sure of the money. You know, possibly Dana White if Vince McMahon gave him a cut of it. And Charlie Sheen, because Charlie Sheen, all he knows is winning. But I said the lose part of it would be for all the other participants involved, including the fans. And I said, because here's what would happen. Okay, and you said it, and you were pretty much accurate. If the fight was a legitimate shoot, who would win? Brock Lesnar.
Yeah, Lesnar would take him in a heartbeat.
Exactly. So now, what is the big build-up to WrestleMania every year? The Undertaker streak.
Right.
So they put a legitimate fight together, and Brock wins. Well, now you just lost the streak. So that.
Well, what the plan was going to be was it was supposed to be the streak versus the UFC heavyweight title. That's what Vince wanted. He wanted the streak versus the UFC heavyweight title. They probably would have done some disqualification or like a count out or something like that.
And then what would have happened? All the fans would have been ripped off. And I think it would irreplaceably damage Brock's reputation. It would have hurt The Undertaker's reputation. And a lot of people that, you know, watched it just because of, you know, the curiosity would have felt ripped off. So say you're an average fan, you're like, oh, my God, this could be really great. And then it turns out to be a ripoff. Then you got a bad taste in your mouth.
Yeah, and let's be honest, too, the match was sucked, you know. This year at WrestleMania, instead, you got The Undertaker and Triple H, which was phenomenal. I mean, it was fantastic. I think one of the best matches in Mania history. And, you know, I'm sorry, you know, Brock Lesnar, he's a hell of an athlete, but he's not going to go out there and do the stuff that Triple H was doing. I mean, why would he? Why is he going to fuck through a table when he could cut his leg and you know, take himself out of mixed martial arts competition for 8 months? He's not going to do that. They're going to go in there, and they're going to have a safe wrestling match. And The Undertaker's banged up, and there's only so much that he can do, and it's just not going to be good. You know, it's funny because people got so excited about the possibilities of Brock Lesnar coming back for a wrestling match when people have short memories, because Brock Lesnar's last wrestling match was horrendous. It was against Bill Goldberg. At WrestleMania 20, and it sucked.
It was terrible. The only thing that was any good about the match was Steve Austin's referee.
Absolutely, and yet people are getting excited about seeing Brock back. I'm saying, you know, I don't see Taker against Triple H or anybody else but Brock Lesnar.
Did you go to the Royal Rumble in Philadelphia in 2004? That was the one that was when Chris Benoit went number one to win it.
No, the only pay-per-view I went to two pay-per-views in Philly. I went to Mind Games, the one with Foley and Shawn Michaels, and that awesome match. Yep. And I went to King of the Ring. I'm gonna guess it was '96. It was terrible. What's that?
Is that the one Mabel won?
Yeah, that was the one.
Yeah, I had free tickets offered me to that. This was before the days, you know, cell phones and everything. And, you know, my cousin had won free tickets from, like, some radio contest. And she called Mom up at work. I was at my job at the time where I wasn't allowed to take personal calls.
Mm-hmm.
So she called my mom up at work. And my mom's like, he probably won't want to go to that. And then I come up and I'm like, call her back. And I'm like, oh, we came away 10 minutes ago. But, yeah, from what I heard, that pay-per-view sucked anyway. So.
I was going to say, you're better off not going. it was terrible. I used to go, when I was younger, I used to go to a lot of WCW, well, NWA pay-per-views back in the day, because there used to be a guy named Joel Goodhart, and he used to run bus trips. He used to have a wrestling radio show, and he used to run bus trips. He used to run bus trips to all pay-per-views. So, and it did. It's WCW. WCW would run a lot of time, like in Virginia, New York, like the Nassau Coliseum, places like that. Like, I went to the Great American Bash 89. I went to Starrcade 88 in Norfolk. And, you know, and at the same time, too, you would meet other people on these trips. So maybe next time WCW comes to town, we just wind up pulling together in a car or something. So, I went to a lot of the Great American Bashes in, I want to say, 89. I went to the pay-per-view, but I also went to a lot of them because they would do the tour. And they would do different matches in each city. And I went to Hartford, Philly, and Baltimore. Used to travel on the bus trip, like up to D.C. and see NWA shows. So, yeah, I used to travel. And I had family, my aunt, my grandparents, and my aunt. They lived in Long Island, New York, when I was a kid. So I would go up there, and twice my aunt took me to the Nassau Coliseum to see WWF, like way back in the day. So it was pretty cool to be able to go to different arenas and stuff.
Yeah, I mean, when I went to that one in the Royal Rumble of 2004,
mm-hmm.
You know, a friend of mine and I, we got tickets. We got them at, like, half price. They were $100 seats. You know, lower level, like, where you're not, you weren't on the floor, but you were at one level above at the, Wells Fargo Center now.
Yeah.
But they were sweet seats. But you're talking about Brock Lesnar. He had a match with Hardcore Holly on that show that was absolutely horrendous. It was horrible.
Was that the one where he dropped him and broke his neck?
No, that was the one that was, it was the revenge match.
Oh, okay.
It was like, all right, you broke my neck. Now I'm going to get you back. Because then Holly had the match won. He gave him his Alabama slam, and then it was like he wanted to try to break Lesnar's neck, put him in full Nelson, he gets out of it, F5, it's over.
But what I always felt hurt live shows, like I went to a SmackDown taping and a Raw taping back in 01. One was SmackDown taping was right at the WrestleMania when Steve Austin had turned heel. And then the other one was actually right after the Invasion show when Steve Austin had once again turned heel. And then I went to that Royal Rumble in 04. And what hurts them is because they do so much to build up to the TV audience that it's like, you know, sometimes like you don't feel like you're getting into it as much as being part of the live show. Because I honestly was missing hearing Jim Ross and JR and you watch this and like, I'm watching this one match. I'm like, God, this is terrible. But I could just imagine Jim Ross and they're like, oh my God, he's up, I can't believe it. And then I'm watching on TV. I watch them later on TV. I'm like, yeah, this is actually pretty good.
Yeah, it happens. It happens quite a bit.
Eric, what would you say is the best moment so far in your career?
The best moment in my career. I have a couple. I'd say one right off the top was calling the November Rain Hardcore Homecoming show as a play-by-play announcer. What was awesome about that is, you know, I never had the chance to do play-by-play announcing on ECW because I got into play-by-play announcing after ECW had closed. And this was the closest that I would ever have. And it was all the same guys. It was the same building. And it was just really cool to be, you know, a big part of that show as an announcer and allow that memory to live on, especially since ECW is such a big part of my career early on. Cage of Death 3, I thought was a really something I'm really proud of. And I say that because we were running CZW at the time. In CZW, we were running the small building in Sewell, New Jersey. We were drawing, you know, if we were lucky, 250 fans. We drew 500, I think it was, for one show. But, I mean, but that was it. And that was, like top of the food chain. And we had TV on every week here in Philly. And we caged at F3 at the ECW Arena. And we didn't even know what to expect. And we got there that night, and there were lines of people, like, around the corner. There was probably 1,200 people in that building. It was an awesome show, an awesome atmosphere. And I just felt like I was a real important part of something, you know, by helping week in and week out on my commentary and helping pump the show, along with just the phenomenal crew of guys that I was working with at the time. It was just a really cool sense of accomplishment to all, you know, together, because, you know, we had all been together, some longer than others, but, you know, from when we were running like 100 people in the building, you know, 150 people in the building, and here we are now. Not only are we in the ECW arena, but we're selling out, and that was pretty awesome. For me, just having the opportunity to do pay-per-views, I mean, how cool is it, you know, to have people from around the world order your show and watch you on pay-per-view. I mean, it's just a really cool feeling, a really cool vibe. MLW as well was a good deal. Oh, and I guess I would have to say the first Ring of Honor show. I called the first Ring of Honor show with Steve Corino, and I think it's my best work as an announcer. And the matches were fantastic. Me and Steve had great chemistry. And, you know, I remember being in the locker room that night and just looking around at all these guys and girls and just thinking, man, this is the cream of the crop of independent wrestling, and I was a part of it. And I felt very lucky to be a part of it. And, you know, even though my stint was very short there, I'm very proud to have been, you know, to have called those first two shows, and especially that first one. And I guess just, you know, my career overall, I mean, I just feel, you know, very, very blessed and very lucky. Again, you know, I'm no different than anybody else. I'm the same, you know, 8-year-old wrestling fan that sat in front of my TV for 3 hours on Saturday morning watching wrestling. They saved me my money to go to the store and buy wrestling magazines and bugging my dad to take me to wrestling matches. I'm that same guy, and you know, I was just lucky enough to get some, have some doors cracked open for me, and I took the ball and ran with it and was able to just enjoy, you know, just a real great life out of it. I mean, it was just awesome.
And the one thing I was going to ask you, with a lot of the wrestlers that, you know, you've met, you know, during your association with some of the sport, who are some of the guys you can really point out and say that, and despite, you know, how their characters act, because, you know, sometimes you'll get the guys on, like, you know, the TV, like the biggest jackasses in the world that are actually some of the really the coolest, nicest guys in the world. Who are some of the guys that stand out to you as guys you really, you know, like as, you know, being cool, being down to earth,
yeah,
being fun to get along with?
Yeah, definitely. Top of the list, easily, Bruno Sammartino. I've had Bruno Sammartino on my radio show as a guest more than anybody else. Now, you know, Bruno was winding down his career as I got into wrestling as a wrestling fan, so I didn't live in the Bruno era. But being, you know, a big fan of wrestling, you know, and enjoying the history of wrestling, I mean, I was aware of Bruno and just looked up to him. And I remember just being so nervous when I had him on my radio show for the first time, just because he was, at that time, the biggest guest that I ever had on my show. And I'm proud to say that 10 years later, after having him on my show, he's a friend of mine. I mean, the guy is just phenomenally awesome. When I was in college, he actually helped me with a college project. I mean, you know, he didn't have to do it. I mean, there's no promotion. He's not getting on a radio show. I mean, it was just between me, him and my professor. So, I mean, to him, to me, he's just absolutely top of the food chain. Honestly, you know, just about all the guys that I've had on my radio show were great. Steve Austin was a super cool guy. I had him on my radio show. I met him in person once or twice. Just a really cool guy. Chris Jericho, super, super nice guy, super cool guy. Who else? Dusty Rhodes, really nice guy. Terry Funk, I mean, he's the best. Yeah, you know, I guess, you know, just about everybody, you know, I mean, I guess the real question would be who were the biggest jerks? And I really can't remember any, you know, I mean, anytime I've met somebody, it's either been at, you know, with my radio show, interviewing with them for my radio show, and they've always been really cool, or when I worked with them, you know, doing announcing at a wrestling show and stuff, and it was a lot of fun. Oh, okay, here's a good story. Larry Zbyszko, I did commentary with Larry Zbyszko in San Francisco at the Cow Palace back in 2007. It was for a show that was taped for pay-per-view, but it just never made it to air. And I was, you know, I was booked to do commentary with him. And, you know, here I, you know, the whole entire time I'm a nervous wreck because I'm thinking, you know, here's Larry Zbyszko. He did Nitro. He did, you know, he was a WWF wrestler, big time. And, you know, he's probably going to jabron me. He's probably going to treat me like a piece of crap, you know, because I'm just this independent wrestling announcer. But the guy could not have been cooler. And, you know, and I actually got friendly with him. We had great chemistry calling the show together. And the irony is, like 3 months later, we wound up working together again and calling a Pro Wrestling Unplugged show together. So that when I saw him at Pro Wrestling Unplugged, it's like we were old friends. And that was super cool. That was super cool because, you know, it, again, to me, it's like this guy is, you know, a Nitro, you know, this guy was on Nitro every week, you know, and he doesn't have to sell me or anything. And he was just, he was super, super great to work with. Steve Corino, probably, you know, right there with John Alsa's, my favorite commentary partner. You know, I didn't know Steve Corino before. Well, actually, I had a little bit of an incident with Steve Corino before I met him. There was some kind of a miscommunication with him in my radio show, so there was a little heat there. So when we got paired together to do Ring of Honor, again, I was a little nervous because I'm thinking, well, is he going to jabron me? Is he going to, you know, just be a jerk or a prick? And again, the guy couldn't have been cooler. We had phenomenal chemistry. Again, another guy that I have a friendship with that I've called shows with him in other places. I called shows with him, I think, for two other promotions we worked together. I know we did MLW together. I'm pretty sure we did another one together. And yeah, it's really, you know, it's something you get when you're done the show, when I'm done the show, that I feel really proud of. It's like, you know what, I held my own with these guys and, you know, got their respect. And there's not much more than you can ask for than the respect amongst your peers.
All right.
Speaking of ponies, what do you think about The Rock coming back?
I thought it was awesome. I mean, you know, who doesn't like The Rock? You know, I mean, he's just so much, he's head and shoulders, just world above anybody else that's currently in wrestling. You know, and not for that saying a whole lot, but yeah, I mean, he really gave the product a nice injection, and his promos were worlds better than anybody else's in wrestling today, other than Steve Austin's on Tough Enough, which is just phenomenal. But yeah, I loved it. I thought it was great.
I'll tell you, one of my favorite Rock memories was that one Raw that I was telling you about right after Steve Austin's second heel turn of 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Which was when they invited The Rock to come back, and then, of course, who's he going to choose? Who's he going to choose? Is he going to go with WCW and the invasion, or is he going to go back to the WWE?
Oh, right. I remember that angle.
So the show's in Philadelphia, and at first, like, they show a limousine pulling up, and here comes Shane and Stephanie out running to the limousine. Here comes Vince out running to the limousine, and it's Chris Canyon. Everybody's like, oh, boo.
Uh-huh.
And then all of a sudden, they show the Rocky statue, which was right across the street at the Spectrum at the time.
I remember that. Yeah, I remember this angle.
Standing with the Rocky statue, giving the people's eyebrow, place went nuts. I mean, and didn't have to say a word, the place went nuts.
Yeah, that was awesome. That was great stuff.
Now, what would you say you enjoyed most about the sport of wrestling and doing what you do, writing about it, play-by-play?
Oh, man, that's a lot there. I guess, you know, it's something different for each one of them. For play-by-play, I just love doing it. You know, I love calling a match, and, you know, it's one of those things where just being a big wrestling fan growing up and really respecting the announcer's position and to be able to go out there and do it, like I said, and have the respect of my peers. What I really enjoy more than anything is after I call a match, and then whether it's a week or months or a year later or whatever, you know, the guy that I called their match for, you know, they go out of their way, they pull me aside, or they get in touch with me, they call me or email me or something. They're like, I just want to tell you that you're, you know, what you did was phenomenal on there. What you did was really good. And that, to me, is just awesome when that happens, especially when it's like a veteran or somebody like that. That's just great. And especially with a lot of the guys that I came up with on the independents, you know, in CZW and stuff, they would, you know, always ask me to call their matches and stuff. And it was just, you know, it's just, to have that respect amongst your peers again is just, it's just great. With writing the Camel Clutch blog, I guess just its growth. You know, again, it was something I kind of just started because I used to write professionally for a newspaper website. And when I switched jobs, I didn't realize that I missed that passion for writing. So I just started Camel Clutch as, like I said, just a regular blog to just write about. And here I am 2 years later, and it's a monster. I mean, I get almost a million people that come to visit the website a month. I have, you know, important people that read it, like, you know, people in professional broadcasting, pro wrestling, you know, MMA and stuff that read it or drop me a line or an email about it. You know, it just continues to grow. And, I mean, it's just, it's really humbling, you know, when I see, like, just 2 weeks ago, a story from Camel Clutch. Like, I have syndication deals with some places, and one of my stories was featured on the front page of Fox Sports. I'm just like, man, you know, who am I to be, you know, featured on the cover of Fox Sports or to be, you know, mentioned in CNNSI or something like that? And, yeah, just the continued growth of it is just really something else because I never expected to get a business out of it. I thought it would just be fun. But it's really turned into a business, and it's opened up, like, world of opportunities for me that I never had before. So I'm just very proud of it, and I work my ass off on it. I really do. I mean, I work sometimes 8 to 10 hours a day on it, and, you know, it doesn't pay what a full-time job pays. I mean, it does okay, but it doesn't pay what a full-time job pays, but I work my ass off on it. So it's not like I just lucked into something and, you know, and it just kind of happened. I mean, I work hard at it. And just with wrestling, you know, honestly, there's not a whole lot I enjoy these days because I'm really much more of an MMA fan these days than I am a wrestling fan. But, of course, I still follow wrestling. You know, I like Evan Bourne. I like the high flyers like Rey Mysterio, Sin Cara, you know, people like that. I'll be honest with you. I loved WrestleMania. A lot of people hated it, and I wrote a positive WrestleMania blog on my website about it, and had people, you know, coming at me like, oh, how can you do that, you know, this, that, or the other thing. You know, I liked it. What can I tell you? I liked it. I love Steve Austin on Tough Enough these days. And, and I'll tell you another – I'll tell you, you know, listeners, another great story that, you know, it's all opened up just through my career in wrestling and my Camel Clutch blog and stuff, is I just got married a month ago, a little over a month ago. We had our first month anniversary a couple days ago, and I had Howard Finkel doing my wedding introductions at the wedding, and it was awesome. I'm not gonna lie. It was freaking cool. And Howard was phenomenal. I mean, the coolest guy in the world. And what was funny about that is, you know, most of the guests there were probably my wives. And my wife's guests, you know, they're not really big wrestling fans. But, you know, her girlfriends aren't, but their boyfriends were. So it's like, here you have these guys. I mean, you know, we're guys. We don't like going to weddings. We don't really like to be dragged to weddings, especially people we don't know. So, you know, most of these guys probably didn't want to be there anyway. They were just going for their girlfriends or their wives or fiancés and stuff. But, you know, all of a sudden, the Fink comes in the door, and it's like, Jesus Christ, this is the best wedding that I've ever been to. It was awesome. And they were all coming up to me. They still email me or whatever, and they're just like, I just want to tell you, that was just phenomenal. That was awesome. At some point on Camel Clutch blog, I'll put the video up on YouTube and link it out. But yeah, that was very cool.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Those are pretty damn cool. I mean, I could see myself being there, like, okay, I'm at a wedding, blah blah blah.
Right.
Oh shit! I was like running up there, like, yo, I gotta ask you about WrestleMania 3, you know? And
he was super cool because he hung out at the cocktail hour so people could ask him questions and take pictures. And he hung out during dinner for a while. It wasn't like, you know, he didn't pull the celebrity card. It's like, oh, I'm doing my gig, my party introductions, and that's it. Don't talk to me. Don't look at me, you know. The guy couldn't have been any nicer. I mean, really. And again, you know, I think we developed a friendship out of it because I've talked to him since, and, you know, and he didn't really know about my background as a ring announcer, and we bullshitted for a while there about my background and his background. He loved hearing, you know, my stories because it's just something you can relate to as a ring announcer, you know, from ECW. And it was just a blast. But yeah, you know, all these guys are sitting there and kind of moping and, you know, waiting for dinner and cake, and all of a sudden the thing comes out and they're like, holy shit, I know that guy. And yeah, it was pretty awesome.
I'll tell you what's funny. I'm going back 10 years now. It was November of 2001. And I don't know how familiar you are. There's a small nightclub in Bluebell called Reed Bluebell.
Absolutely. I know Reed's. I know Reed's. Yeah. I've been there.
Yeah, I mean, because it was where I lived in Glenside. It was 20 minutes away. Where I live now, it's 20 minutes away. So it's a good, easy place to go. I know everybody there, you know. So a couple years, back in 2001, I see them. They're having the Gorgeous Ladies of Extreme Wrestling.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. I used to be involved with them, too. The Dangerous Women of Wrestling, the Gorgeous Ladies of Outrageous Wrestling.
Yeah. So that was the first night I ever met Lucky. He's a very good friend of mine.
Oh, the Luxor. Tell Lucky I said hello, man. I like that guy.
Will do. I'll text him tonight as soon as we get off. But Lucky's great. It was the first night I ever met him. So I'm going there, and I didn't know what I was supposed to take a friend of mine for his birthday. You know, I'm like, we're going to see some chicks wrestle tonight. He can't go. So I ended up taking two other friends of mine. I'm like, I don't care. I get there early. I'm sitting there next to the guy that used to wear the straw hats to all the ECW matches.
Oh, yeah, but the sign guy.
Yeah.
Or the hat guy.
So I'm sitting next to him. So I'm like, oh, this is great, you know. And then they were having intermission. They were having Polaroids during intermission. I'm like, oh, you know, what the hell? I don't have much money on me, but maybe I'll get a Polaroid. And I pick out one girl. Now, she wasn't one of more like, you know, she was more of just a solid wrestler. Most of the girls in the car were more like TNA appeal.
Yeah.
Weren't as good wrestlers, but the one girl, she looked pretty damn good, and I thought, frankly, she was the best looking one on the card. I'm like, I'm getting my picture with her.
Yeah.
Turns out, Mickie James.
Oh, yeah, that was her back in the day. Yeah, absolutely.
She was her Alexis Lurie days.
Yeah, I used to love calling her matches. They're always really good. I mean, you know, you won't find many people in the independents that worked with her before, you know, she went there as Mickie James that weren't fans of hers, because she was one of those talents on the independents where it's like, man, she's kind of too good to be on the independents. She really should be doing something else. And I remember I actually watched WrestleMania 22, the one where she wrestled Trish Stratus. I watched it at a party with a bunch of the crew from Dangerous Women of Wrestling. It was one of the owners. We went to his house. He had a big WrestleMania party. So it was all the girls and the crew from there. And we were all just super proud of her, you know, seeing her in the ring like that. It was really cool to sit there and watch, like, one of our own, you know, kind of graduate to the big time.
Yeah, and like I said, that card, I had a great time. I still got the pictures of it. And like I said, that was the first night I met Lucky. It was a tag team mixed main event, and you know, he took a chair shot that night, and you know, I was sitting in the first row next to the Hat Guy, and one of the girls got like thrown right into me, which I didn't, you know, mind all that much. And
right.
That was great, you know?
yeah, it's good stuff.
Now, Eric, you said you're a big fan of MMA, so I got to ask you, what do you think about the Strikeforce merger there with the UFC, even though they're not really calling it a merger?
Yeah, kind of bummed about it, because I always liked Strikeforce. I really did. You know, I really got into Strikeforce's fighters, and the thing about Strikeforce that I always liked, and, you know, a lot of it's luck, and a lot of it's just good matchmaking, is they, 9 out of 10 times, they had great shows. And, like, you can't say that about UFC. And then again, I mean, you know, UFC has, like, 10 shows for every one Strikeforce show, you know, per year. So, you know, you have a lot to choose from. But, you know, there aren't many great UFC shows, I think. There are a lot of really good ones, but there's not many great ones. And there were a lot of great Strikeforce shows. So, you know, it kind of bummed me out and when they merged. But, you know, at the same time, as a fan, I am super stoked for the possibility of all these dream matches and, you know, unification matches and stuff. And, you know, it really is something that can I think, take the sport to another level, because, you know, just to have the idea, you know, the idea of two champions fighting from two promotions, I think that, you know, even casual sports fans can get behind that, even if they're not MMA fans. Casual sports fans can get behind that. And I think it opens up a lot of really big opportunities. I just hope that, you know, I hope Strikeforce stays alive, because I was a huge Pride fan back in the day. I liked Pride more than I liked UFC. And when UFC bought Pride, they promised they were going to keep Pride alive and keep it separate, and Pride never came back. So
yeah,
I hope they keep Strikeforce alive. I hope they keep them separate, but they mix and mingle every once in a while. But, you know, I was kind of bummed at first, but, you know, it's something I think that could be good for the entire sport, which for somebody like me that writes a blog, an MMA blog, anytime UFC or WWE increase in popularity, it's always great for me as a blogger, because it's just more people that are interested in reading about WWE or UFC or Strikeforce and that kind of thing.
Yeah, I was actually one of the people who helped write the story of Pride get ripped apart and dismantled. I actually helped out the lawyer who sued the UFC and the Fertittas, and I got a website called ScienceSucks.com.
Oh, God.
So I've done a lot of investigative reporting behind the scenes. So that's one of the things that I really hate about the UFC, is that their business-mindedness is sort of like... you know, ruthless. Well, it's not sort of, it is ruthless. And even though a lot of it can be considered legal, it almost shouldn't be. And you have the situation with Pride, where I think they learned a little bit of a lesson, fortunately. And that's why they're doing this with Strikeforce, where they're allowing it to continue, and then maybe they'll take it over and merge it. But they've learned, at least, you know, you got to let the contracts run out, and you have to... you know, have sort of a finale, at least, give these guys a chance to stick with it. But at the same time, I think Strikeforce's problem that led to this was just that they needed capital. You know, they needed somebody to come in and invest and you know, prop the company up for a little while, because there's main strategic investor left.
Well, actually, from what I've heard from a couple of people, is really the impetus on the failure of Strikeforce was the signing of Fedor, because as great as Fedor is and as big a ratings draw as he is, his contract was just too much for what Strikeforce was making. And it just got to the point where they couldn't – where he really bankrupted them big time, that without Fedor, they would have been perfectly fine. And they also – you know, the other thing, too, is they had a company behind them that kind of peaked, you know. The company that owns the San Jose Arena, the San Jose Sharks Arena, they owned a part of Strikeforce, and they really weren't interested in growing Strikeforce. It's like, all right, you know, it's like steady as a hand, you know. We'll just do what we can to stay afloat, and, you know, that's just not going to cut it anymore. But really, it was the Fedor signing that really put them behind the eight ball.
Yeah, I believe it. And one of the things that I always kind of thought differently from a lot of fans is that, you know, Dana White should have signed Fedor, I thought, not because he needed him, but because he needed to expose him earlier than he was actually exposed.
Yeah.
Fedor had gone to the UFC at the time that Dana was out there negotiating with him. I think he was, you know, maybe first or second fight, he put him up against the best in the UFC.
He was going to put him against Brock Lesnar in the first fight. He said it when they were negotiating. He thought that he had him locked up. And I even wrote a blog because he had told reporters that Brock's next fight after he beat Frank Mir at 100 was going to be against Fedor. And he offered Fedor a contract that was reportedly somewhere in the $30 million range. And Fedor refused to sign there, to sign with Strikeforce for like $2 million. Now, you know, as much as I can't stand Dana White sometimes, and I most of the time I can't, you can't blame him for that. It was really Fedor and Fedor's management that they knew better. They didn't want to get in there and play with the big boys.
Yeah, I guess so. Maybe, I mean, I always thought that he's been fighting pretty much bums in the last few years until
he
went to this tournament. And even Verdum wasn't expected to beat him, but...
No.
Sort of a fluke there, but it was a long time coming, and it was bound to happen. But one thing that I think that a lot of people aren't thinking about, but is going to happen now that they've had this takeover, is I bet what's after Randy Couture's next fight, that fight that they were trying to make between Randy and Fedor is finally going to happen. And if Fedor loses, that would be a good fight for him to retire on.
Yeah, definitely. Hey, I hate to cut it short, guys, but I actually have to run.
Hey, no problem.
This is a lot of fun. I hope we can do this again.
Sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Definitely.
We'll definitely keep in touch. I actually noticed you got a lot of different blogs and websites listed on your site. And we have a Ring Girl contest, so I noticed that you've got the Intimate Apparel site.
Oh, yes. That is one of my affiliate sites that I own, yes.
Yeah, maybe we can work together and advertise for that in exchange for getting some gear for our Ring Girl prizes or something.
We can definitely talk about it. Drop me a line and we'll talk off the air.
All right, great. And is there anybody you want to give a shout-out to or thank before we leave?
No, thanks for having me on. And, again, hopefully, you know, some of your great listeners will check out Camel Clutch blog, and that's over at you don't need to put the W in there. It's CamelClutchBlog.com, just CamelClutchBlog.com, where you can follow me on Twitter, at CamelClutchBlog. And, hopefully they'll check it out and give it a shot.
All right. Well, great. It's been awesome talking to you, and it's good for us to get back to talking a little bit about wrestling. We try to say that we cover wrestling, but we don't do enough of it, so.
Awesome, guys. Well, you know, I really enjoyed being on. It was nice to kind of mix it up with, you know, MMA and wrestling and even a little Flyers to start it off. So that was a lot of fun. Have fun at the game, and I'll talk to you guys soon.
All right.
Good. You better come back and win this game for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Have a good night, guys.
You too.
All right. See you later.
Take care.
Damn it, I thought they were about to score there. They get an empty fucking net and they miss it.
Oh, man.
It's the same thing at Chet.
That's the worst. Well, we do have a little bit more to cover. We pretty much covered all the boxing matches this last weekend. There was one that I didn't mention. Jesse Vargas is now 15-1. Beat Vivian Harris by RTD in the first. What does RTD stand for? Referee something?
Technical
decision or something?
I don't think so. Retired? Like, what round was it?
The first.
Okay.
No, we wouldn't have taken the decision in the first. Probably what happened is the person, you know, threw in the towel. They retired. They, you know, said, I've had enough. Waving the white flag.
There must have been a brutal beating, man. I didn't see any highlights, but we also have to cover the rest of the Strike Force card that happened this weekend. And we had, I talked a little bit about the Diaz versus Daly fight and some of the controversy there. Before that, we had Keith Jardine from UFC fame fighting Gegard Mousasi on very short notice. And it was a surprisingly good show put on by Jardine, who has had a lot of good outings in the last few years. And he had a particularly brutal fight with Chuck Liddell in one of his last fights. But definitely Mousasi did enough to get the win, and the judges ended up coming out with a majority draw. And one of the funniest lines I've heard in MMA in a long time was when they gave the mic to Jardine after the fight, and he said, "Yeah, it's kind of like kissing your sister to get the draw." You know, he really wanted to win. But one good thing about it is that it makes it pretty evident they're going to have a rematch between those two. And it was a good fight. You know, there was a lot of back and forth. It was a real bloody, reckless fight on both guys' parts. It was not very technical, not necessarily toe-to-toe action. There was a lot of different angles, a lot of different positions, and it was entertaining to watch, that's for sure, but it definitely was a fight that I thought Mousasi should have won on decision. I don't see how the judges could have scored it for Jardine. But, you know, MMA judges do what they want to do. Actually, I saw a clip this past week that really interested me. And it, unfortunately for the referee, it was a guy who's much maligned in the sport. And he's been at every level. His name's Cecil Peoples. And he's been at every level of the sport, all the way up, I think, to Strikeforce. I don't know if he's been a judge for the UFC, but he's made a name for himself more as a bad judge than a bad referee. But this time he was a referee in a very small cage fighting league. And I saw a clip online of him reffing this one fight, and this kid gets a guy on the ground, and the kid taps out, and the ref didn't see it. So the kid stops fighting and tapped the other guy out, and the guy that just tapped out starts fighting again and starts punching away at the other guy who's sitting up against the cage now in frustration. And the kid who tapped out won the fight because he got the TKO. You know, so it's just like, I could not believe that could happen. And I don't know whether they changed the decision to a no contest or whatever, but I know that's happened in the past in some fights. They should have done that if they didn't. But being a smaller league, you know, maybe they just didn't have their shit together, so to speak, and didn't get that done for the guy who should have won. But this wasn't that bad, but it was bad enough to make people say, "Oh, here we go again." You know. Also on that card, we had Melendez. Just blow through his opponent. Unbelievable fight. And he's out there talking about unifying the Strikeforce UFC titles already. So I think that's going to be interesting to see if they do allow that to happen. And also, before I stop talking about that card, there was, I think, a couple other fights. The Daly Diaz fight was really one of the best MMA rounds I've ever seen in the sport. And I haven't watched a whole lot of MMA. And you could obviously argue that the fight that most people think was the best ever, Forrest Griffin and Stephen Bonner, was probably better. But honestly, I never even watched it, even though I've heard so much about it. I probably should watch it, but I never did get to see that. I wasn't a fan of MMA back then when the Ultimate Fighter first started. And speaking of the Ultimate Fighter, we had one of the fights on that show this week. We between a guy named Ryan McGilvery and Len. And so I can't think of the guy's last name right now, but that was kind of interesting. Speaking about Brock Lesnar, Lesnar had to leave the camp to go tend to some personal business. And it was kind of funny the way that he dismissed the cameras when they asked him about it, I guess. And he said, well, you know, my personal life is the most important, and everybody knows that. And then he left. And so he wasn't there for his fighter, and his fighter ended up losing a very tight decision. Could have gone either way. It was a first round that could have been a tie, but the second round I thought definitely went to McGilvery, who was fighting for the Santos team. So he got the win. And Brock Lesnar wasn't even there to see his fighter or cheer his fighter on, because he had personal business to attend to. But, of course, we never found out what that was. And I know that after watching an interview with Brock, he talked about, you know, having a lot of vacation time out here in Vegas. I think he went somewhere with his wife. And he said it was personal time. But hey, if I had a wife like that, I'd be going places with her, too.
True. Very true.
So, other than that, no offhand what we got coming up. What do we got for boxing coming up this weekend? You got the advance report for us?
Well, man, that's a great question. Let me, before I take any stupid-ass guesses, which I'm good at doing, let me take a look. See what we got rocking and rolling out there.
It was good to finally get back to watching a lot of boxing this last weekend. There was, the Adamek fight was really interesting because I got to see a couple guys that I haven't seen in a long time, Goody Petronelli and Mike McBride there.
Well, you're still not in Vegas, are you?
I am still in Vegas.
Yeah, why don't you move out there, man?
Pretty much what I'm doing.
Yeah, I can see. I'm just taking a look at the box rec, see if there's anything. Friday night, nothing really of interest. I'm looking on here, and so far I don't see a name that I recognize, which is usually pretty odd. I think the fight's I gotta see what's on ESPN too. I'm not 100% sure, because I won't be home tomorrow night. I got a chaperone on the first date. Doesn't that sound like fun? chaperoning. Well, you got two people that neither of them have a car. And my younger cousin, she was trying to get a date to the prom, couldn't find one. I don't know why. I mean, she's got to be good looking. She's related to me. So I decided to set her up with a son of a friend of mine who's also very shy, and he's scared of me, which is even funnier. So I was working on that, and then I'm like, oh, they want to meet before the prom, and my cousin wants to see this movie, and this kid wants to see this movie. And they're like, yeah, should we go to the 7 o'clock show? I'm like, yo, idiots, I gotta work till 5. I won't get home till like 5:45. I said, you two live about an hour away from each other, and neither of you have a car. So you guys got to figure something out. Don't throw it all on me. Like, it's a moron. Well, Saturday night, looks like we got a pretty interesting fight. Welterweight title fight. That is between Andre Bartel and Vicious Victor Ortiz. And, Bartel has looked pretty good in the last fight. Impressive knockout win. He's had some fights where, he struggled a little bit. But now you got Ortiz, who's a power-punching fighter. But, his legacy right now is still hurt a little bit from the, loss to Marcus Madonna. So, Bartel is 27-0 with 21 knockouts. Ortiz is 28-2 with 2 draws and 22 knockouts. His last fight was actually a draw with Lamont Peterson, who's a, highly ranked fighter. So, that ought to be a very, very interesting fight right there. Also over in England, bloody old England, we got Amir Khan fighting a 12-rounder against Paul McCloskey. Amir Khan coming off of that bloodbath win over Marcos Madonna back in December. He's stepping back in the ring. Khan is 24-1 with 17 knockouts. That one was a pretty devastating one, though. He got blasted in one round by Brady Prescott. And he will be fighting Paul McCloskey, who I got to admit I don't know much about. Might be stepping in a little bit over his head. He's 22-0 with 12 knockouts. Looking at his record, you got guys like, I mean, decent record, but, you know, the biggest name really is Cesar Bazan, who he beat 3 years ago, who was a champion back in, like, the late 90s. Most of the other guys on there are, you know, guys that nobody's ever heard of. I mean, you see some impressive records, like 14-1, 15-2, but, you know, where are these guys building their records off of?
Yep. Well, I'm trying to wait for this page to load. I'm sure, Doug, to tell you what's coming up in MMA. But while we're waiting, I just wanted to mention one story that was pretty interesting. The Ontario MMA medical checks have been generating some news because they're very, very strict. And this recently, a 27-year-old father of three was fighting up there in Ontario, and on Tuesday they discovered from a mandatory MRI that he had a brain hemorrhage. Ryan Foster had a brain hemorrhage. He's a former UFC guy, and the UFC is about to have a show up there. So he's one of those guys who didn't really like the idea of having to go through all these trainings, and here it is, it ends up helping him. So that they caught this brain hemorrhage before it got to the point where it was made worse in the fight. So it just kind of brings some attention to these testing procedures. And in the same vein, on the opposite side, there was a woman who made the news the other day because it turned out she fought in a fight when she was pregnant.
Really?
Yeah. She was a couple months pregnant, and the test that she was having trouble making weight, I guess, and the tests came out negative when she tried to check to see if she was pregnant. And she was actually supposed to fight Gina Carano, I think, in June. She's coming back, and so she found out she's pregnant. Now that fight's off, but you know, Carano's going to find somebody else. But still, I thought it was. Thought it was a pretty amazing situation that hadn't been planned for in the past, I guess. But obviously, I think the baby's going to be fine. I think it was a quick fight. I didn't read the entire story, but definitely.
Well, that's good.
So that's just kind of crazy. Going to have to watch out for that from now on in MMA. And here it is. Sure, dog is up. So I'm going to tell you what we got for fights real quick here. Speaking of ECW, we have EFC, actually, Extreme Fighting Championship, Africa. Oh, I didn't know there was one in Africa. In South Africa, on actually tonight. Then tomorrow night, we have Fighting Marcou Challenge 4 in Florence, France. Friday night, Fights 3 in Mexico. Hybrid Combat Proving Ground 1 in Quebec. Nature of the Beast in McAllen, Texas. And Central Pennsylvania Warrior Challenge in East Stroudsburg, wherever that is. Central Pennsylvania, I'm guessing.
East Stroudsburg is actually, it's not as central PA as Lock Haven. It's more like Northeast.
Oh. Well, then we have Fight Night 7 from Scrap Live in North Carolina. Amateur 11 Ring of Combat, Rahway, New Jersey. And let's just get to the quick, the big ones. On the 16th Saturday, we got Bellator Fighting Championships 41 from Yuma, Arizona. King of the Cage has a couple events, one in Colorado. called Texas for some reason. And then Underground 68 in Peshawestown, Michigan. That's pretty much all the big shows. And since we're running out of time here, we're going to sign off. And until next week, have a good one, folks. And
have a great one. Until next week. We had a great show tonight. I had a lot of fun. Can't believe I'm talking to people that know people that I know. But it was pretty awesome, man.
Yeah, it was a good time. And,
all right. Well, I'm out. Till next week. Go Flyers.
Check out the blog for all your updates. And keep checking for the Ring Girl contest and all that stuff. And see you next week. And we'll have a great guest on for you.
Adios. Later.